Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me on the other end of the line is my mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. Glad to be with you. We have a really, really good book to tell you about today.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When Mom got this finished reading before I did, and she said, this one's a page-turner. This one is like the most page-turner of any of the books we've ever done. You've got to find out what happens.
Absolutely true.
So you want to introduce our guest today, Mom?
Yes, I would like to. Excuse me. Jenny Lecote was born in the Channel Islands, where, only 16 years ago, Nazis had deported members of her family to concentration camps for resistance activities. Following an early career in stand-up comedy and writing features for magazines and newspapers, she became a screenwriter. And her feature film, From Another Mother's Son, about her family's experiences during the occupation, was released in the UK in 2017, and The Girl from Channel Islands is her first novel, and I'm hoping that they will make this into a movie, too, because we watched the other one, and oh, gosh, oh, tell you, it's great. Just great.
So welcome to Writers' Voices, Jenny.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So you went from comedian to journalist to screenwriter to novelist. Give us fill us in a little bit on how all that happened.
Okay. Well, I started off, I started off playing in folk clubs. When I was about 16 years old, I used to get changed out of my school uniform and go down and play Janissian songs and my own compositions down at the local folk club. And that slowly became a lot more chat and turned into a stand-up routine. And I was kind of in the right place at the right time because the whole alternative cabaret scene was just starting in London at that time. So I did stand-up for 11 years. And during that time, that sort of led on to other things. I wrote for magazines. I wouldn't call myself a journalist exactly because I never really did, proper journalism. But I used to do a lot of think pieces for magazines and papers and some interviews of celebrities and stuff like that. And I did a little bit of presenting at the same time and some acting. And then I retired from stand-up at the end of 93 because I wanted to get into comedy writing. And that's what I did for a while. I started in sitcoms for TV, and that moved on to soaps and dramas. And it was kind of a natural progression. And then in the sort of the 2000s, I started doing more sort of serious, researched, long-form pieces. And that's about the time I started thinking about maybe covering my family story.
Okay, so The Girl from the Channel Islands is about as far from comedy as you can get.
Yes, it is, isn't it? If you come this for laughs, you'll be disappointed.
Yeah, that's for sure. So was this story something that you knew about growing? Well, first of all, we'll talk about, we did watch the movie, which is on Amazon Prime, I think.
It's on Amazon Prime at the moment. That's right. Yeah.
And it was called Another Mother's Son, and it is set in the Channel Islands. And that is actually your family story, true?
Yes, that's right. There's two projects here, one of which was 3 years ago when the film came out. And that was the first piece that I'd ever done about the occupation. And it's because it had always been a wallpaper to my life, growing up in Jersey, because both my parents had grown up as children in the occupation, and my grandparents had raised families during the occupation years, which was very, very hard. And so I'd grown up having been born 15 years after the end of the war, thinking that it was ancient history. But of course, to them, it was really only just gone. And I was aware that my family had been involved in a certain amount of resistance activity. My grandfather, for example, used to make crystal radio sets because they weren't allowed to listen to the BBC or to possess radios after 1942. And my great aunt on my mum's side of the family and several of her siblings sheltered a Russian slave worker. These poor souls were brought over from Eastern Europe as slave labor for the fortifications that Hitler wanted to build. they were kept on little mini camps, treated like animals. And sometimes they would escape from these camps, but they were trapped on the island. So people would take them in and hide them from the Nazis. And that's what my family did. But unfortunately, they were betrayed and it didn't go well for them. So that's what Another Mother's Son is about. And that was my sort of first proper research and my first proper project of writing about that period.
Now, was one of your grandparents a character in that movie?
Well, my grandfather was involved in that story, but actually it's my great aunt, mm-hmm. my great aunt Louisa Gould, who, of course, I never met, who she was the one who hid this guy that they named Bill for security, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. And they hid Bill in the house because she lost her own son during the early stages of the war. And she told a friend of hers that she felt that she had to take this young lad in because, in her own words, she had to help another mother's son, which is where the title comes from. And she was assisted by her siblings, my great uncle, another great aunt, and the whole family were really involved in it. I'm very proud of them, but it was, you know, mistakes were made, and mm-hmm. that's really what the film is about.
So in the film, there's two sisters, there's Louise and then Ivy.
That's right.
And then their brother, what was his name?
And the brother Harold. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and he was sent to a concentration camp and was, and I believe, was the only British citizen to survive that camp.
That's right. Yeah. For obvious reasons, not that many Brits were sent to, because the rest of the British Isles were not occupied. The Channel Islands were the only occupied territory of the Second World War. People get kind of confused about that because people don't know exactly where the Channel Islands are. They don't know, you know, which country they're part of or if they're independent. And the fact is they are actually legally independent. They have their own governance, but they are part of the British Isles and they're what they call a crown dependency. So they're part of Britain, but geographically they're much closer to France. They're only about 14 miles off the coast. So when the Nazis came across France in 1940, they basically invaded the islands, knowing that as far as they were concerned, it was a stepping stone to invading the rest of Britain, which is, of course, what they hoped to do. And the Brits were not able, the government's not able to defend them. They basically left them to it. And the islanders were left completely defenseless against the might of the Wehrmacht.
Wow. And a lot of us didn't know that much about this, but there was one other book that was written, 10 years ago or something? The Guernsey Literary...
Yes, the Potato Peel
Society.
The Literary Society, yeah. And that became a film. Yes, right. I've read the book of that. There's been a few novels, actually, written about... there's been a few novels written about the occupation. I think maybe enough time has gone by now that people are starting to get interested. For a long time, it was something that wasn't very well known, wasn't discussed. Weirdly, you know, when the film came out in 2017 here, there were lots of my friends who said, I had no idea about any of this. So even British people don't necessarily know the whole story. So it's kind of a part of history which hasn't had that much attention. So hopefully this will put that right.
And your family was on the island of Jersey.
That's right. Jersey's the biggest out of several islands.
Okay.
There's Jersey, Guernsey, Alderney, which was used pretty much as a concentration camp during the war, and Sark, which is tiny. And then there's a couple of additional islands which are not inhabited. But they're very small. I mean, Jersey is only 9 by 5 miles. So once you're invaded, once you have an occupying force there, there's no way off the island. You're stuck there for the duration.
Now, Jersey and Guernsey are both cattle breeds also. Is there a relation there?
Well, all my family, if you go back, they're all French farmers. And yeah, my grandfather, my on my mum's side, was a farmer and they used to keep cows. In fact, he got into trouble for stealing cows during the war, which is a whole other story.
Oh.
The Jersey cows are a very, very sought after breed and they're used for breeding all over the world.
Yeah, and Guernseys too.
That's right.
Yeah, both of them.
But there's a lot. We don't talk about that in Jersey. There's a lot of competition between the islands.
Oh, I see. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jenny Lacote, author of The Girl from the Channel Islands. Now let's move on to this story and how you found out about it.
Well, this was a story which had kind of been buried for a long time. I think the first time anyone got any wind of it was when a Channel Island historian first interviewed Hedy about it in about 1998-99. And it started to get into some Channel Island history books around that time. But the story really came to public attention a few years ago when Dorothea, who is one of the main real characters in the book, was awarded a Yad Vashem award for her assistance during the war in helping to keep Dorothea alive, with enormous personal courage. So that kind of brought it to public attention, and there were some news items about it, and the house where Hedy was hidden now has a blue plaque outside it in Jersey. So that was the story that I sort of first heard about it and realized that, it would make an incredible story. There was so much information about the occupation that I hadn't really had a chance to get into a movie script, because obviously films are much tighter, more organized formats, and there's not much room for additional information. And there was so much that I hadn't managed to get into that about the occupation background. So I thought this would be a good opportunity.
What was that award again that you referred to?
It's a Yad Vashem, which is awarded by Israel for services for those who assisted Holocaust victims.
Wow.
And Dorothea was posthumously awarded one of those in, I think it was 2016. So, yeah, that's when the story really became public knowledge.
Now, why did you decide to write The Girl from the Channel Islands as a novel rather than a screenplay?
Well, it was partly because I'd already done a screenplay, because I'd already done Another Mother's Son. And I thought it was going to be difficult to sell another occupation film. Mm-hmm. The other part was kind of personally as a writer, was that I'd made an attempt about 20 years before writing a novel, which had been quite a disastrous attempt. Nobody wanted that. And that book is now buried in the garden with a stake through its heart, because that's really, really, really bad. So I just thought I'd like to, I've got another 20 years experience. I'd really like, before I sort of retire and give up, I'd actually like to give it one more go to see if I can pull this off. And the story itself was so good, but there was only the bones of the story were known. So there was plenty of room for creativity and for fictionalization. And I thought, well, this is a good opportunity to use all that additional information about the occupation that I hadn't managed to get into Another Mother's Son, which was, very, very focused on the relationship between Louisa and Bill. So I wanted to have that opportunity to get that sense to people of what it must have been like to live through the occupation. It's something, obviously, I didn't live through, but I spoke to my grandmother about it. She, before she died, we did a tape-recorded conversation about it. And I've spoken to my dad, and I've spoken to other people who lived through that experience. And I really wanted to try and bring it to life. So I decided that a novel would be, if I could pull it off, would be the best format for it. But when I was writing it, I honestly thought I would be very lucky to get it published at all. So the success of the book has taken me quite by surprise, I think.
So was it published in the UK first?
It was published in the UK. It was, as I kind of thought would, if I was lucky, it was a small independent publisher in Edinburgh, in Scotland. And it was published here as Hedy's War. And then other publishers in other countries began to get interested, and HarperCollins approached me just over a year ago and said that they'd be very interested in publishing it there under a different title. So here we are, and just found out today we're number 10 in the New York Times bestseller list.
Oh, that's fantastic!
I know.
Congratulations!
I'm just thrilled. I know.
Yes,
absolutely extraordinary.
I'm not surprised. I'm not a bit surprised.
Wow. So what do you learn from writing this novel in terms of, how do I word this? Like, how is it, you talked a little bit about how you're could put more detail in, that a screenplay is much tighter, but what else did you have to learn to be able to successfully write a novel?
Well, I learned that it's really, really, really hard. I never expected it to be easy, but it was even harder than I thought. It's so much longer than a screenplay. I mean, a screenplay is much more manageable. And you're writing a book of, 90,000 odd words. By the time you're three quarters of the way through, you can barely remember what was in the first chapters. The other issue I had, I suppose, was just how to tell the story, because I'm used to working in pictures and dialogue and trying to work out when it's appropriate to go into people's heads, how much description to give without it getting too purple and too indulgent, but giving enough description that people can see what I'm seeing in my head. It was very difficult. I did have some help. I went to see a professional writer who helps train people for novel writing, and she was very useful. She gave me some really good tips, and I used several novel writers for help. I think it's really important when you're starting out in a new format to, even if you're experienced in other formats, to know that every format has its own rules and its own difficulties, and to, to give it the respect that it deserves, really. So, yeah, I there was a lot of there were many drafts of the early chapters.
But then you got in the swing of things.
Yeah, once I'd got the first three chapters and the style right, and I knew who the voices were going to be, then it got a lot easier after that. But I plan the story the same way that I would storyline a screenplay, because I don't really know how else to do it, to be honest. I work it out in the same way that I would plan a screenplay, with turning points and acts and stuff like that, and then just try and fill it in, and then after that you just keep going over it and over it and hope that your experience and your instinct kicks in.
Well, I was going to ask you if you, as a novel writer, were a plotter or a pantser, and it sounds like you're a plotter. Are you familiar with those terms?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I do know people who, get up one day and write chapter one and off they go. I have no idea how people do that. For me, that's like, getting into a car, blindfolding yourself and driving off without any idea where you're going. I have to know what, obviously, things take on an organic nature and things change as you go along, but I would, I absolutely have to know what direction I'm going in before I can start planning, getting anything like detail or paragraphs together.
This character in the book, Kurt, he is a hero to me. And I was just wondering, you think there were many German soldiers like that?
Well, I think it was always, the thing is, it was such a checkered history. There would have been people on the islands who were very, very committed Nazis, who believed utterly in Hitler's insane theories. But there would also have been people there who were drafted, who went along with it because it was very, very difficult not to go along with it politically. There would have been people there who started to have second thoughts about it, even if they'd had some enthusiasm at the beginning. And my view of this was that because we know that Kurt fell in love with Hedy and must at some point have known that she was Jewish, my feeling was, I don't believe that anyone could do that if they were a committed Nazi. So I took the perspective that this was a man who, however he found out, and we don't really know in real life at what point he found out she was Jewish, so that's something that I've created in the book. But the idea that he would have had that relationship, and not only that, but risked his career and his life to keep her alive when she went into hiding, which we know he did. I don't believe that that's someone who was committed to the Nazi cause. I believe that was someone who was trapped by the nature of the war, in the same way that the islanders being occupied were trapped by it. We know that there were many Germans towards the end of the war who desperately wanted the war to end, and who were very unhappy about being trapped there from the, kept from their families for so many years. We also know that there were German soldiers on the island who, when they were redrafted and sent to the Eastern Front, actually committed suicide because they couldn't stand the thought of it. So the idea that, that the entire Wehrmacht was full of very committed people is inaccurate. There were plenty of people at the top who believed in those things, but that's not true of everyone involved.
Well, that's what makes this, to me, what makes this book so great, because you have so many different characters and with different ideals and different values, and it comes out in this, even though they're in a situation where they can't move left or right hardly,
Well, I think everyone always wants a simple narrative for these stories. There was a narrative about the occupation not long after the war ended, which was that Jersey and the Channel Islands hadn't really suffered that much, the occupation hadn't been too bad, but everyone had behaved very well indeed, and it had all been very stiff upper lip, and no one had really suffered. And of course, that wasn't true. The islanders suffered very badly, and not everyone behaved well. That narrative then went the other way in the 90s when further research came out, and people started to believe that, yes, the islanders had suffered, but most of them had collaborated and that they had behaved really badly. And neither of those things is true. The truth is always more complex. And whoever people are at the beginning of a trauma like that, that's who they're going to become as that trauma goes on. I'm sure we've all seen this during the pandemic. There are some people who have really risen to the occasion and behaved well and taken care of neighbours, and other people who have simply used that to their advantage and have behaved atrociously. And unfortunately, when people come under tremendous pressure, that's when you really find out who they are. And that was certainly true of that was true of all of occupied countries in the war, and it was certainly true of the islands, I think.
Well, they were struggling to survive, and they barely had enough to eat, and I mean, it was, I'd never heard of these islands or thought about them. I probably heard of them, but you just never thought anything so close to England, to Britain could be occupied.
It was a very, very severe occupation. Not so much the first year or two, when the Germans wanted to promote it as a kind of a model occupation. They wanted it to be a kind of a PR campaign for the kind of occupation they intended to have in Britain when they believed they would conquer it. But of course, that fortunately never happened. Yeah, it was that last year of the war, after the Allies invaded the continent, was particularly harsh, because the islands were cut off from France and from England. And as a result, there was no food supplies. So they had no communication with the outside world. Food was very scarce. The Germans took most of what was being produced on the local farms. And there were people who starved to death, certainly. And there were people who became very ill. There were diabetics who died because they couldn't get insulin. It was a very, very dark period. And how my family survived it, I'll never know. But I give monthly now to the Red Cross, because it was the Red Cross that arrived in the end of 1944 and basically saved them. If it hadn't been for the Red Cross, there would have been many more deaths.
Were they still occupied at that point?
They were occupied right up till May 1945, because the islands were so heavily fortified, Hitler being absolutely obsessed with the idea that this is where the Allies would attack. But the Allies looked at the fortifications and realized that the amount of resources and manpower they would have to use to retake the islands was just impossible. So Yeah, they basically went around them and came back for them a year later.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Jenny Lacote, author of The Girl from the Channel Islands. Jenny, why don't you read a little bit from the novel?
Okay, I'm going to read a little bit. I don't want any spoilers. I don't want people to have any... I don't want them to have any spoiler for the story. So I'm going to read a little bit from the very beginning of the book.
All right.
And the first chapter is set in Jersey in the summer of 1940. The sun's heat had begun to mellow, and the gulls were cruising for their final catch of the day when the siren sounded. Its wail climbed and fell, calling out over the jumbled slate roofs and church spires of the town, and across the patchwork of potato fields beyond. In St. Oban's Bay, where the waves lapped and fizzed on the sand, its warning finally reached Hetty's ears as she lay dozing by the sea wall, and woke her with a jolt. Rising in slow motion, she scanned the sky. Now she could also hear a faint tinny whine in the east. She tried to steady her breathing. Perhaps it was another false alarm. These warnings had become a daily event these past 2 weeks, each time the reconnaissance planes merely circling, then disappearing back out to sea, with cameras crammed full of blurry images of main roads and harbour walls. But this time, something was different. The engine sound contained a note of brutish intent, and now several tiny black dots were emerging in the distant blue. The whine became a hum, and the hum a strident drone. Then she knew. This was no reconnaissance mission. This was the start. For days now, the islanders had watched the black smoke rise and mushroom on the French coast, felt the vibration of the distant blasts pulse through their bellies and rattle their bones. Women had spent hours counting and recounting the tinned foods in their larders, while the men squashed into banks to withdraw the family savings. Children had yelled their complaints as gas masks were forced over their heads. By then, all hope had vanished. There was no one here to deter the aggressors. Nothing between them and their shimmering prize but flat blue water and an empty sky. And now the planes were on their way. Hetty could see them clearly now, still some distance away, but from the outline she guessed they were Stukas, dive bombers. She spun around looking for shelter. The nearest beachside cafe was almost a mile away. Stopping only to grab her wicker bag, she sprinted for the stone steps leading to the walkway above and took them in three bounds. At the top, she scoured the promenade. 100 metres towards First Tower was a small seafront shelter. It contained nothing but a single wooden bench on each of its four exposed sides. But it would have to do. Hetty hurtled towards it, grazing her shin as she mistimed the leap onto the low plinth and threw herself against the bench. A moment later, she was joined by a panic-stricken young mother, probably not much older than herself, gripping a small, white-faced boy by the wrist. By now, the planes were over St. Helier Harbour, one arcing across the bay towards them, the noise of the engine so thunderous that it drowned out the boy's screams as the woman pushed him to the ground. The violent rat-a-tat of machine-gun fire stung Hetty's ears as several bullets found the sea wall and zinged off in random directions. A second later, a distant explosion shook the shelter so hard, Hetty thought the roof might collapse. Was that a bomb? The woman's face was ashen beneath her tan. Yes, near the harbour, I think. The woman gave her a brief, confused look. It was the accent, Hetty knew. Even in a moment like this, it still set her apart, marked her out as an alien. But the woman's attention quickly turned back to her child. Oh, my God, she muttered, what have we done? My husband said we should have evacuated when we had the chance. Her eyes fixed on the sky. Do you think we should have gone? Hetty said nothing, but followed her companion's gaze upward. She thought about her employers, the Mitchells, staggering onto that filthy, inadequate cargo boat with their screaming child, and nothing but a change of underwear and a few provisions stuffed into a brown packing case. At this moment, with the aroma of burning aviation fuel in her nostrils, she would have given anything to be with them. Her knuckles turned yellow on the slatted bench. Corkscrews of charcoal smoke drifted across the bay, and she could hear the little boy beside her sobbing. Hetty swallowed hard, and focused on the questions bouncing round her brain like a pinball. How long now before the Germans landed? Would they round people up? Stand them in front of walls to be shot? If they came for her, then... There was no point finishing that thought. Anton, the only person on this island she could call a friend, would be powerless to help her. The shelter vibrated again and she felt its fragility. Hedy remained crouched silently, listening to the planes loop and dive and the crack of explosions a mile away, until at last the sound of the engines began to fade into the distance. An aging gentleman with dishevelled white hair stumbled toward them and stopped to peer into the shelter. "The planes have gone," he called. "Try to get home as quickly as you can. It can't be long before they get here." Hedy's eyes fixed on his jacket, which was covered in dust and uneven patches of blood. "Don't worry, it's not mine," the man assured her. "Old fellow walking near the harbour took a bullet in the leg. We had to get him to the hospital." "Are there many hurt, or..." Hedy glanced towards the little boy, not wanting to finish the question. "Some, yes." The man's voice faltered a little, and Hedy felt a surge of anguish. She pressed her fist to her lips and swallowed again before he continued. "They bombed a line of potato trucks waiting to unload at the harbour. I mean, for God's sake, what's the point of that?" He shook his head and gestured towards the destination. "Hurry now." The man hastened away. Hedy hauled her shaking body to its feet, wished the woman good luck, and set off along the promenade towards the town, wondering how on earth she would get back to the Mitchells, assuming the house was still there. She tried to hurry, but her skinny legs felt weak. She imagined Hemingway cowering beneath the sofa in the empty living room, his grey feline fur stiff with terror. Already she was half regretting disobeying Mr. Mitchell's instruction to have him put down. The animal's trusting eyes had melted her heart at the door of the vet surgery. Now she wasn't even sure if she'd be able to feed herself, never mind a cat. By the time she reached the outskirts of St. Helier town, she could hear the bells of the ambulances and the random shouts of desperate men trying to work as a team. Smoke rose in perfect columns from boats and buildings in the windless summer evening. Cars lay abandoned on the roads at odd angles. There were a few people about, some searching for the missing, some wandering aimlessly, and one old couple on a bench, sobbing. Hedy walked on, forcing herself to put one foot in front of the other, deliberately edging her mind toward reality. The seas around the island were probably already full of U-boats. Soon she would once again be surrounded by those grey-green uniforms and hear the barking of orders. She pictured the bang on the door, Wehrmacht hands grabbing at her elbow, the house abandoned with dirty dishes still on the table. Anything was possible now. She recalled only too well the Germans, the way the Germans had behaved in Vienna, especially towards Jews. She pressed on, pushing her body weight forward, willing herself home. She needed to reach Hemingway and give him a hug.
And that was Jenny Lecote reading from her novel, The Girl from the Channel Islands.
And you can see why you want to turn the page.
And Jenny, I must say that you are one of the best readers that we have had on the show. And I think it's not just because you have the British accent, which of course is always appealing, but just the amount of, well, I guess it's your acting background and your
background. I did do a little bit of acting in the old days, but I didn't stick at it very long. I read a couple of reviews and decided they were right.
Ah, okay. Well, now, is The Girl from the Channel Islands available as an audiobook?
It is, available as an audiobook. It is indeed. In fact, I was sent a copy the other day. So it's available in all formats, I think. And it's available as paperback, hardback, Barnes & Noble stock it. The independent shops, of course, stock it. I'd like people to support their local independent bookshops at this time. And online, you know, wherever you are, just type the title in. I'm sure you'll find it.
Right. And were you involved at all in making the Audible book, like approving the reader or anything like that?
No, I think I would leave that up to the publishers, but also reading a whole book, doing an audiobook is a very skilled job. You have to play all the characters. You have to get the tone right of every scene. It's a very tricky job and above my pay grade. I think I'll let the professionals do that.
We also encourage people to support their local bookstores, and if you're not able to do so in person, one of our authors told us about bookshop.org, where you can order online and you can either choose a specific bookstore that you are ordering from online, independent bookstore, or in any case, the proceeds will benefit independent bookstores.
Absolutely. No, I really encourage people to support those independent places because they've suffered far more over the last year than the chains have. So if you can do that, that's great.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that I was wondering about was the book is written primarily from Hetty's perspective, or she's the protagonist, mm-hmm. and most of it is from her perspective. Some of it is from Kurt's. You go back and forth a little bit on point of view. Why did you choose her as the protagonist rather than Dorothea?
Well, I had a think about that, but I decided that, there were so many ways you could have told this book. You could have told it from Dorothea's perspective, and that would be a very different book, I think.
Yeah, it would. Definitely.
You could tell it entirely from Kurt's perspective. There were different ways of doing it, but I thought Hetty being the main person, she was the victim at the beginning of this. She was the one who had to make decisions. So it made sense for me to write it with her as the main protagonist. And I felt that the relationship between her and Kurt was kind of the core relationship of the book. So that's what I went with.
How much research were you able to do? Like, were you able to, Hetty's probably not still living. But
No. She died a number of years ago. Yeah. I mean, there's certain amount of research that was available to me in terms of what was remembered by people. But Kurt sadly died quite young, and Hetty never spoke about her Jersey life experience. So as a result, we only know the kind of what I would call the foundations of the story. We know that she arrived in 1938, that we know that she worked for a Jersey family, that she tried to lie her way out and say that she wasn't Jewish when the Germans arrived. And we know that she worked for them and that she used that situation to her advantage and got into trouble and had to go into hiding. And we know that it was Dorothea who she lived with on West Park Avenue. And we know that we also know that Kurt was one of the people who kept her alive by bringing them food. So the foundations are all true, but what we don't know is how any of those people met. We don't know how the relationships formed. We know that Dorothea was married to Anton. But those are things I had to make some sort of creative decisions about because we just didn't have the information.
And Anton, is it known that he was also from Austria?
Yes, he was okay. An Austrian. He worked in the bakery and he married a local Jersey girl, which again, that was a very contentious relationship then too.
Do we know how Hetty ended up in Jersey? You know, why she came there?
Well, she escaped the Angelus. She had to escape to the other side of the continent, I guess. I think she might have been actually trying to get to the United States initially. I think there was someone that she knew there. But for whatever reason, either because she couldn't get the papers or she ran out of money, she arrived in Jersey and didn't get any further. And I probably felt safe. I mean, certainly the islanders up to about 1938, 39 probably felt pretty safe themselves. So she would have thought that she was far enough away. But of course, by the spring of 1940, with the Germans coming across France, she would have realized her mistake. And by that time, it was too late.
Now, Jenny, you mentioned that your family had been French, were French. How did Jersey and the Channel Islands end up being British rather than French?
There's a long history to the Channel Islands. That would be another program, to be honest, to go into at this point. The Channel Islands have always hotly disputed over many hundreds of years between France and England, but they have been part of Britain for several hundred years. Yes, and they are very proudly British, I think, and as you say, a crown dependency. So they have representatives of the crown. The bailiff is the lieutenant governor are representatives of the crown in the islands.
Wow. Now, Jenny or Hetty didn't seem in the book to think all that highly of Dorothea initially. But from what you've told me, I'm guessing that this is something that you had to use creative license on their relationship.
Yeah, that is creative license because we don't actually know anything about their relationship at all. I sort of used the information I had about Channel Islanders and people, you know, the kind of people who lived in the islands who were not very worldly at that point. They certainly didn't have the international travel that we have now. We needed some kind of journey for the book. If they'd been best friends from the beginning, then there would have been nowhere for that to go. Mm-hmm. So I think it was more interesting for the story for Hedy, the main protagonist, not to want to be locked away with Dorothea. But I hope, as we'll, you know, as readers will see, that although Dorothea is a slightly unusual character at the beginning, and I think perhaps we share Hedy's slight scepticism about whether or not this is someone she wants as a friend, but actually Dorothea proves herself to be perhaps one of the most moral characters of the book, and you know, perhaps one of the most important features of the whole story. She's a character I grew immensely fond of as I wrote her.
Oh, I bet. Now, do you know, did her family disown her about her marriage to Anton?
They did at the time, okay. Yes. Yeah. We know that marrying someone who was, even though he wasn't technically German, but he would have been associated with the German side. And of course, as far as the Germans were concerned, he was a countryman. So, yes, there would have been a lot of issue with that. And of course, Anton was then drafted into the German army. Mm-hmm. So, yes, she would have taken a huge amount of flak for that.
Wow. I wonder how those men like Anton, how they could justify the things they had to do, you know, because they weren't Nazis, and it's you know, you wonder, and Kurt too, you know, because he probably had to do some things, men like him, as pretending to be a Nazi. It must have been a real talk about PTSD. It must have been really, really hard for them to do that.
I think many people in the island had PTSD after the war, to be honest. I think it was quite prevalent. The fact that it was very difficult for me to get my grandmother to talk about it many years later. I think it was such a dark period for everyone. I think that in fact the book that I'm working on now is about after the occupation and the aftermath that it had, because that's not an area that most people have written about so far. And I think it's quite an interesting unexplored area, but actually the repercussions of that 5 years went on long after the war.
Well, that is interesting.
I look forward to that book.
You do allude a little bit in The Girl from the Channel Islands about like some of the young women who fraternized with German soldiers, maybe not always willingly, or maybe just for survival. You do allude to perhaps they weren't treated very well afterwards.
Oh yeah, there were some women who had genuine relationships with German soldiers, and there were other women who used that situation for whatever reason. There were some that probably quite enjoyed the experience. There were others that were probably doing it for food and to help their families. So again, it was one of those very checkered subjects, which is sometimes presented in a very simplified way, which is not the case, and it certainly didn't occur as much as many people have said it did. But it certainly went on, and yeah, they were treated. Yeah, they were quite ostracized after the war, I think.
That could be an interesting story too.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's it's one of the errors that has come up before.
Yeah.
Guys, it's been wonderful talking to you. I have another interview to do in a few moments.
Oh, okay. All right. So, all right. We will let you go then. So.
But it's been really lovely, and it's been great to share this with you, and thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for writing these, the movie and the book. I mean, it was weird.
Well, I hope people will enjoy both, and I hope they'll get a sense of the history, and and that they'll take something away from that.
I believe they will, and we can't forget that history, because, as they say, people who forget history are doomed to repeat it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, and look forward to talking to you later.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, you know, this book would have been set during the time when you were a child.
Yes.
Yeah. So what was it like here back in the U.S. during that time?
Well, of course, we didn't have TV, but we went to a lot of movies, and in every movie they had newsreels to tell people what was going on in the war. And I remember once they were showing some of the atrocities in the concentration camps, and what they were doing to Jewish people. And I turned to my mother and I said, those are God's chosen people. Mm-hmm. Actually, we were pretty well insulated from the war, because we always had enough to eat. There was rationing, but my mother canned everything. And my grandparents were farmers, and so we always had meat. They canned meat, and they all had big gardens. My mother had a huge vegetable garden, and we didn't really suffer. We didn't suffer.
Did they call them victory gardens?
Yes, they did. That's what they called them. They called them victory gardens.
Now, your mom, but she gardened even before that, didn't? Wasn't she always a gardener?
Oh yeah, yeah, she was.
And
yeah.
A lot of people were then too, and. You know, I think people did tend to garden, you know, grow their own food and can their own food more back in those days than we do now.
Mm-hmm.
But the recent, you know, with the pandemic and people being at home, there's a shortage of vegetable seeds because so many people have planted gardens.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I just heard about that.
Okay. Okay.
So we're all getting back to our roots a little bit there.
Yeah. Well, you know, Monica, we have had several books about the Second World War, novels and so
yes.
forth.
Yeah.
And there seems to be, you know, a recurring interest in it. And I suppose part of that is because the generation that fought is mostly gone, like my Uncle George, who was a foot soldier in Germany, and of course he died a few years ago. And my uncle Ed, who was in England, he was stationed in England. He was a mechanic on I think it's B-29s. So you know, but they're gone now, and so those maybe that's why these books are so interesting to me.
Yeah,
anyway.
And Ron, your husband,
yeah.
who was in Iceland,
a Reykjavik,
So maybe it is partially because sometimes the people who lived through it don't necessarily want to read about it, but those that came after do. I mean, a lot of mm-hmm. some people who lived it but didn't want to talk about it, let alone read about it afterwards.
I wonder what will happen now, 20, 30 years from now, when they talk about this pandemic.
I know. My grandkids, my kids are in Texas, and right now as we're recording this, Texas is not just dealing with the pandemic, but also with a once in a century snowstorm, you know, weather event, loss
mm-hmm.
of power, loss of water.
Mm-hmm.
My son and his family were without power for the better part of 2.5 days they're finally, they lost power early Monday, and on Thursday, I think it's back fairly consistently now, but they still don't have water. And I said to him, you know, I texted to him, well, your kids are going to be telling the stories about this for years to come, you know, for their whole lives. This is like a something they're really going to remember. And also with the COVID, and it's hard to know, you know, I saw somebody on Twitter say, are you going to want to read novels about this 20 years from, or even a few years from now? Are we going to want to read about it, or are we just going to want to forget about it?
Yeah, well, yeah. See, that's it. I mean, but it's like the Second World War.
Yeah.
People, we enjoy reading about it because it's history. And yeah.
Also, part of it is we know how it ended.
Yes, we know how it ended, yeah.
And we know, you know, even when you're, most of the time, most of the stories that we read are people who are about people who survived, but occasionally not. We had an author, I can't remember the title now, where the person did not survive, you know, did not make it to the other side, and I really thought she would.
I know. Yeah, I remember that. Like, how many years have we been doing this, Monica?
We've been doing this since 2006. It's now 2021. So in October, it'll be 15 years.
Oh, my gosh.
It's
a wonder we can't remember it. You can probably remember a lot more books than I can.
Well, I could Google them on my in my calendar or in my Gmail and probably find them. And most of our interviews are available on writersvoices.com. Hundreds and hundreds of them are available there to go back and listen to.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, because we used to be, of course, live at the radio station in Fairfield. And
On Crew, which is no longer broadcasting. But, so that had its own pressures doing it live. It's a little easier to record in some ways. Although the advantage of the live broadcast was it took an hour, period. I had to show up a few minutes ahead to get things set up and leave the studio exactly on time, and there was no editing. That was it.
Yeah, that's right.
So now I spend a little more time recording. I have to do a sound check ahead of time, and then I do a little editing at the end. So it takes twice as long to do the show as it did then. Well, because Jenny LeCote, our guest today, had to leave a little early, we have some additional time. So I'm going to read from the book, The Girl from the Channel Islands. And this is a section that's written from Kurt's point of view. Kurt was the German officer. He was not a Nazi. At this point in the story, Hetty is in hiding, and Kurt is trying to help feed her. Kurt stood in the hallway of his billet, listening hard. Fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on how one looked at it, this was a creaky old house, and every footstep on the upper floors could be heard downstairs. Other officers were moving around, padding across their rooms, crossing to the bathroom, closing doors. This was a useful time of day, he figured, when those on night shift had already left, and the rest of his colleagues were taking advantage of this break to wash, write letters home, or snooze on their beds. In about 15 minutes, Fisher and the rest would pile downstairs for their evening meal, prepared by housekeeper Mrs. Mezick, a local woman who came in daily to collect laundry and cook for the officers. Evidently, she was a cousin of the original residents who had evacuated in 1940 and considered this a way to keep an eye on the place. She only spoke, if absolutely necessary, and pocketed her wages each Friday with a sullen nod. Most of the officers ignored her or made tasteless jokes about how grateful she'd be for their attention. Kurt often sniffed his dinner before eating it, knowing full well what revenge he would take in her shoes. Strolling into the kitchen with what Kurt hoped looked like casual interest in tonight's menu, he found Mrs. Mezick stirring a pot on the stove and smiled at her. She acknowledged him without anything resembling a greeting. Kurt adjusted the chairs around the kitchen table as if preparing for a dinner party, then sat down. "What is dinner tonight, Mrs. Mezick?" "Pork stew." Kurt nodded with enthusiasm, wondering which poor local farmer had their valuable porcine asset grabbed by soldiers and loaded onto a pickup. Still, this meant there were likely to be further cuts of meat in the larder. Hetty had refused pork in the early days, but any such cultural taboos had long been discarded. "Sounds delicious, but, oh, by the way, the window in the bathroom is jamming again. Would you mind taking a look at it, please?" She turned to him with a look that could sour milk. "I'm not a handyman." Kurt beamed at her. "Of course not, but you have a, what is the English word? A knack." Mrs. Mezick laid down the wooden spoon in her hand and, without trying to hide the roll of her eyes, shuffled out of the kitchen to see to it. Kurt leapt up and opened the larder door, taking care to place a finger on the ball catch to prevent it making a pinging sound. It was dim inside, but as he suspected, a decent-sized leg of pork lay on the back shelf covered by a sheet of muslin. All Kurt needed was a sharp knife to hack a slice off the front. He was about to take one from the drawer when he heard footsteps on the stairs. Dang it, he would have to sneak down in the early hours to complete his mission. He moved quickly to the sink and pretended to be washing his hands. "Evening, Newman." Fisher was dressed smartly and smelled of scented soap. Where he got hold of something like that, Kirk could only guess. "Waiting for dinner?" "I am. I'm starving." Kirk kept his tone light and playful. "Good day?" Fisher grunted and threw the local paper onto the table. "Bloody waste of time. Had to attend the burial of those Allied seamen washed up on the beach. Bigwigs decided to send a guard of honor and a firing party. Show respect. I ask you, what's the point?" "Indeed," Kurt thought, "considering how we treat them while they're alive." But he kept his jovial expression pasted in place. Fisher gestured to the paper. "Think there's a photograph in there somewhere." Kurt obediently took the paper and leafed through it while Fisher droned on. "What sickens me is that the Allies are placing sea mines all around the islands, trying to stop our supplies coming across from France, but top brass still insist we doff our caps when we manage to blow them out of the water." Kurt mumbled a passive agreement, but was no longer listening. There, in the middle of the paper, was a photograph of Hetty. It was a professional shot in a formal pose, and from her normal weight and creamy complexion, he knew it must be an old one, presumably taken before the war. Perhaps she had had some portraits done as a gift to send to her family in Austria. Her hair, thick and lustrous, was swept back from her face. Those eyes he knew so well were looking up towards something or someone to the right of the camera, and there was both a trace of a smile and a sense of sadness in her expression. But what drew Kurt's gaze was the text above it in German and the same lines in English below. "Notice. The German authorities are looking for Miss Hedwig Berku, see photograph, typist, of no nationality, 24 years of age, formerly residing at West Park, 1 Cannon Tower. She has been missing from her residence since November 4th, 1943, and has evaded the German authorities. Any person who knows the whereabouts of Miss Berku is requested to get in touch with the Feldkommander 515, who will treat any information with the strictest confidence. Anyone concealing Miss Berku or aiding her in any other manner makes himself liable to punishment." It was signed by the field commander with today's date. Mom, I know you have some good a good quote for us to close this program with.
Yes, I do. This I think speaks to the heroes of this book. The value of life is not measured in length, but in deeds. Mm-hmm. And that was a quote from this Louisa Gould, who was the great aunt of the author.
Perfect. Well, thank you, Mom, and thanks to Jenny, who was with us for most of the hour. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye, everyone.